Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Officials in South Dakota are trying to figure out today why the Keystone Pipeline sprung a massive leak early yesterday morning. About 210,000 gallons of oil spilled in rural South Dakota. TransCanada, the company that operates the pipeline, sent over 75 workers to clean up the site. It is not far from the area where TransCanada is trying to build a sister pipeline, Keystone XL, that has become one of the most controversial energy projects in the country. Joining us now is NPR's Jeff Brady, who's been following the story. Hi, Jeff.
Hey there.
And what are we learning about the extent of the spill today and the damage it's done?
Well, the company was able to shut down the pipeline pretty shortly after there was a big drop in pressure that indicated there was a leak. It took just about 15 minutes to do that. And this is in a very rural area. It's about 200 miles north of Sioux Falls. It's mostly ranch and farmland. There have been no reports of injuries to people or animals. The big concern right now is groundwater. And the state says if some of the local groundwater has been polluted because of this spill, TransCanada will have to pay to clean it up. And on the cause of this spill, no word on that yet. There are no indications of sabotage. I don't see any indications the police are investigating that as a cause.
And 210,000 gallons, is that considered a big spill?
It is significant, but it's very small compared to some of the biggest spills. Take, for example, BP's 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The federal government estimate for that is 134 million gallons. So 210,000 gallons is about one-tenth of 1% of that. But still, a small spill can have significant effects depending on, you know, where it spills, especially if it starts getting into rivers and groundwater. No indications of rivers here, but again, that groundwater could be a problem.
So what is TransCanada doing about this?
They say they have 75 people working around the clock to clean up the spill. They say the spill is controlled. There's no threat to public safety. They have lots of equipment on site, earth movers and these trucks that can vacuum up oil that has pooled in certain areas. And then they have lights so they can work day and night. They say they're trying to send this message that they're really prepared for this sort of thing, that they got the section of pipe isolated quickly and shut it down, and that they know how to take care of stuff like this. And now they say they're committed to cleaning up the spill.
Now, this is the Keystone pipeline, not to be confused with the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, which has been very controversial. And when people hear about this news of a spill, I think a lot of people are going to connect it to the Keystone XL. Remind us about some of the politics of that project.
Right. The Keystone XL, it was supposed to be built by now, but it's had a lot of opposition, mostly from environmental groups, primarily because of the kind of oil that it would transport. If you oppose it, you call it tar sands oil. If you support it, you call it oil sands crude. But in any case, it's this stuff, this gunk that comes out of the ground from Alberta, and takes a lot of energy to turn that into usable crude oil, and that energy releases more pollution into the environment. And so environmentalists just want this oil left in the ground because of all that extra pollution. So they've tried to stop the pipeline because without the pipeline, the oil has trouble getting to market, and it may be left in the ground then. President Obama rejected a permit for the pipeline. President Trump has reversed that and approved a permit. Now TransCanada is shepherding it through the rest of the regulatory process. But even outside of that, there's a question of whether or not it still makes financial sense for this company because oil prices are lower than they were a few years back. And some people suspect that it doesn't make financial sense anymore. TransCanada says it thinks it does, but they'll make a final decision on whether or not they're going to invest the money to build this pipeline probably around the end of this month or beginning of next month.
And the Public Service Commission in Nebraska is considering on Monday whether to permit the Keystone XL through that state. Will this spill change anything?
It's a really sensitive time for TransCanada because Nebraska is where things got hung up in the past, even before President Obama rejected the presidential permit. And it certainly highlights the case that many Keystone XL opponents have made, that pipelines always spill and they're harmful to the environment. I don't think it's going to change the minds of state regulators. They've been considering a lot of other information before deciding this case. So this is one blip in the news, but we're going to find out Monday what their decision is.
That's NPR's Jeff Brady. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
There's another potential pipeline being considered in Minnesota, and 13 young people ages 16 to 24 are making history in the fight against it, joining environmental and indigenous groups in court without a lawyer to present their case against Enbridge Energy's Line 3 project. Now, this is a planned pipeline from Alberta, Canada to Superior, Wisconsin that would replace an older pipeline along a different route. Enbridge is asking a judge to recommend to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission that the pipeline be okayed, but Minnesota allows for so-called citizen interveners to argue their case as well. And this group, which calls itself the Youth Climate Interveners, convinced a judge to give them standing, saying that young people should have a voice because the pipeline could make climate change worse and affect their generation disproportionately. Think Progress says it's the first time in history a group of young people has successfully petitioned the court to represent themselves in a case like this. Akilah Sanders-Reed is an organizer at the Power Shift Network, a nonprofit that supports young people in their efforts to stop the climate crisis. She's also coordinator of the Youth Climate Interveners and joins us now from St. Paul. Akilah, when the judge said you can stand up and be interveners, were you surprised?
I was shocked. It was really unprecedented, and I just remember being so overwhelmed and joyful to know that the judge had heard our voices and had granted us standing as a party, despite the fact that Enbridge Energy, the pipeline company, had very loudly objected to us being allowed into the process.
Well, you were surprised, but were you prepared? Now, you are 23 years old. You graduated last year from McAllister College, studied environmental studies with a focus in history. You had to sort of crowdsource a legal degree to figure out how to do this. What did you and the others do?
We began doing research on some of the local impacts of climate change here in St. Paul and to some of the areas that would be impacted by the pipeline route itself, and started doing research on different topics, trying to find experts who could speak on our behalf. And that includes folks like local climate scientists, professors, ecologists, public health professionals, and indigenous elders. And we were able to pull together a group of 10 highly qualified experts in those fields who are now able to speak in front of the judge as expert witnesses, competing with Enbridge's experts, who are things like chemical engineers and pipeline integrity engineers and things like that.
Well, you know, you had others show you how to find out what the administrative rules are. It's online. As you well know, the supporters of the pipeline say that until cleaner energy comes along, this is what we have and we need it, and it provides jobs. So give me just the thumbnail of what the case is you are making against it, particularly from the point of view of young people.
Well, pipelines like this are unique in that this represents a minimum 60-year investment in one of the dirtiest kinds of fossil fuels, tar sands oil, out of Alberta, Canada, on Earth. And so this isn't just a stopgap measure as we transition to renewables. This is an investment in the fossil fuel industry for the long term. This is saying that this company and anyone who supports it are okay with enormous carbon emissions associated with this kind of oil, far past the deadlines that scientists have set for us to reduce our emissions.
So you have this huge corporation that you're arguing against. Do you understand their point that this courtroom should be for those who've done this before? You know, the stakes are high, and there might be a sympathy factor for kids, and that the company should be able to face people on the same level as them as far as, you know, expertise being in a courtroom.
I think we've proved that we are on a level with them. We've managed to really hold our own against their experts. And the way the Minnesota rules are written is that if an individual feels that they are directly and disproportionately impacted by a decision that's at stake, they are allowed to intervene. So we have a right to be there. We have every right to be in that courtroom and to be representing ourselves. You are not required to retain legal counsel. You are allowed to go in there as an ordinary person and represent what is at stake for you in the decision that's being made.
You say you were inspired in part by Standing Rock. We remember this time last year. Activists camped out trying to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. That went forward.
Well, the experiences out at Standing Rock are one of the reasons that many of us got involved in this process this early on, because we don't want this pipeline to get to the point of ever even starting construction. And there are already, you know, cultural and prayer camps in northern Minnesota in case it gets to that point. And I think that the incredible amount of work that everyone has put in is a testament to the fact that no one wants to be in a situation like that again. And that's why we've spent as many hours and as many late and sleepless nights as we have learning this really complicated and inaccessible process so that we can fight this before we get to that point.
We should say you're 23, but you had a 16-year-old arguing with Enbridge paid experts. What was that exchange?
Yeah. One of the youth climate interveners is a 16-year-old indigenous woman named Rose, and she was cross-examining an Enbridge witness, actually under some pretty heavy fire from Enbridge herself. They kept objecting to everything she was asking because they didn't want it exposed that they had no expert who could even remotely speak to the cultural impacts that damage or even construction through a wild rice area would have to the ceremonial, spiritual, and cultural connection that she and her community have to the wild rice beds up north. And Enbridge was just absolutely unprepared to answer her.
That's Akilah Sanders-Reed, an organizer at the PowerShift Network. They're a nonprofit that supports young people who want to try to stop the climate crisis. She's also coordinator of the Youth Climate Interveners, thought to be the first of its kind, young people able to participate in the courtroom. Akilah, thank you so much, and good luck in the next phase.
Thank you so much.
Time now for our weekly social media roundup. There's a bumper sticker in Texas, a picture of the Treasury Secretary and his wife looking like James Bond villains, and the film Get Out is getting a Golden Globe category it doesn't want. Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us from Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Robin.
Let's first go to Texas, where the Republican Fort Bend County Sheriff Troy Nels posted a picture on his personal Facebook of this truck bumper sticker that pretty much says expletive Trump and expletive people who voted for Trump. Now, the sheriff said on his Facebook he was looking for the owner because the county would consider charging the truck owner with disorderly conduct, but maybe we could come to an agreement. Then the Facebook post was removed, the office said, because of hateful responses to it, but also the driver had been found. Meanwhile, the ACLU pointed out a Supreme Court decision that allows for that kind of language. So what are people saying?
All right. Let me just do the build up here for you, Robin, because this is what the sheriff saw, and he was not very happy. Big white truck, on the middle of the white truck, F-bomb Trump.
Okay.
And F-bomb you for voting for him. He was very upset about this. Now, he posted this on his Facebook page to get some ideas from his constituents. What should we do about this? What are our options? One commentator says, now, if the owner turns his or herself in and then faces charges, please tell me where I can contribute to the legal fund, because these would be politically motivated charges.
We should say the county's point was that you could cause a disturbance if somebody got angry at it and you provoked something. But Karen Fonseca, who's the owner, you know, says, you know, people are actually thanking us for it and we're not going to remove it.
Well, she was getting mixed responses, and police have been pulling her over numerous times, and they weren't able to find a way to charge her just on the bumper sticker alone. Now, you did say that the sheriff took the post down, but not before the ACLU had screen grabbed it. And their comment as they reshared the post was this: no, Sheriff Troy, you can't prosecute speech just because it contains words that you don't like. The owner of this truck should contact the ACLU of Texas. The owner of the truck was found. She used to work at the county jail, and she was actually arrested this week, but on an outstanding warrant, not too due to her taste on bumper stickers.
Okay, well, there's that. Look, we want to take a look at that picture of Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and his wife, Louise Linton.
Oh, that's a good one.
Where they're posing with a sheet of money because it's the first that features his signature. But we remember when she posted the Instagram pictures of them, you know, getting off a government plane and all the government designer, and rather all the designer brands she had on. In this picture, she's wearing some sort of black leather thing. What are people saying?
All right. So in the interest of gender parity, the Treasury Secretary is wearing a dark blue suit, glasses and a red tie. And his wife is wearing a beautiful black outfit, very tightly cinched at the waist with long armed leather gloves. And in the picture that people are sharing, the Treasury Secretary is holding a huge sheet of money. And here are some of the comments. Andy Richter says on Twitter, picking out wallpaper for the cognac swirling room. David Korn from DC, true love. But I love what Brian Reese says. Brian Reese says, I know everybody is having fun piling on Mnuchin over the dollar photograph, but if your signature was suddenly on a bunch of money, I bet you'd take the same shot.
Look, you do,
he's
you
right.
Do, you know, people can wear whatever they want. You don't, you hesitate to do that. But it does, somebody said she's about to use that money to buy 101 Dalmatians. It just kind of is an odd thing.
You see the leather gloves and you think, bah, ha, 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 ha.
Jordan Peele's horror satire film, Get Out, was nominated for a Golden Globe, but it's in the best comedy musical category. He's tweeted out, look, it's practically a documentary. What are people saying?
All right. And some people might take you up on, Robin, the idea that it's even a satire. And they were saying this is a drama film. It's a dramatic film. It's a horror film. Little Rel Howery, who's actually in the movie, says, can I be honest? This is weird to me, says this on Twitter. There is nothing funny about racism. Was it that unrealistic? Now, Francesca Ramsey actually gets it. You may have seen Francesca's work on various comedy shows. And she says, I see lots of people suggesting that the Globes are being shady with this nomination, but they really aren't. It was a strategic move for Get Out. Now, there is less of a competition in comedy and musicals, and previous contenders have been The Martian in the Golden Globes comedy section, and also The Tourist, which was funny, but I don't think it was meant to be funny.
No. And by the way, if you haven't seen Get Out,
so good.
Yeah, I'm hoping this brings more people to seeing it. It's just terrific.
Super scary, but more of a thriller rather than people being hacked up.
Like, guess who's coming to dinner with monsters? Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the Museum of the Bible opens today in Washington, D.C. It is just two blocks from the National Mall, but it's unlike any of the other history or cultural museums nearby. For one, it's privately funded, and its chairman is the CEO of Hobby Lobby, the craft store that took the issue of religious freedom to the Supreme Court in 2014. WAMU's Michaela LaFrac paid a visit.
A few days before the grand opening, construction workers are busy putting the finishing touches on the new building. Right outside, D.C. native Shakita Carter is
curious. Don't have any expectations.
Carter works next door to the Bible Museum. She looks up at its six-story brick facade and asks a question I've been hearing a lot recently.
What does it have? On the top, it looks like it has a glass-enclosed terrace. I'm curious as to what that is, or is it a cafeteria? But I think it's going to be something fabulous.
And fabulous is a pretty good way to describe the $500 million building. For starters, the front doors are 40-foot-tall bronze recreations of Gutenberg Bible pages. Right inside, the lobby's ceiling is covered in digital projections of Bible images.
One of our goals has really to set up immersive environments where people can put themselves in the center of the story.
That's Seth Pollinger, the museum's director of content. He's taking me on a tour, and for a museum that's about an ancient text, there are a lot of modern elements. The museum's designers say it's the most technologically advanced museum. One of the first exhibit pieces we look at is a big video screen that's showing a slow-moving abstract film. It's kind of like looking inside a kaleidoscope.
So this is a dynamic display of contemporary art. He was kind of inspired by the Tree of Life from the Garden of Eden.
It's a little trippy.
It is.
And that's just the beginning. There are handheld digital guides that you can program what exhibits to see based on how long you want to be there. They'll even direct you away from crowded areas. There's a recreation of Nazareth, Jesus' hometown, that you can walk through, and a virtual reality tour of buildings here in D.C. that have scripture on them. Pollinger says the goal is to make people feel connected in new ways to this ancient text.
You see these things all around you, and you get the visitor gets the impression, boy, the Bible has really been involved in so many aspects of life.
The exhibits cover a lot of history, too, like the Bible's metamorphosis from an oral to a written tradition. There are displays on medieval Bibles, the abolition movement, civil rights. But a lot of topics are noticeably absent. There's nothing on the Crusades, the Inquisition, or abortion and gay rights. That doesn't surprise Neil Harris, a historian and museum expert.
I think most people expect that museums will represent a disinterested, objective, well-informed, scholarly approach to whatever it is that is being put on display.
Harris says some of his colleagues in the museum scholar community are wary of the new Bible Museum, but it's not because it's about Christianity.
It's not that religion does not enter into American museums. It's that this museum may be presenting it from a specific angle.
That specific angle is evangelicalism. The museum's chairman and main backer, Steve Green, is the CEO of the craft store chain Hobby Lobby. He's also an evangelical and a proponent of conservative causes. In 2014, Hobby Lobby went to the Supreme Court over whether it had to provide free contraception to employees. The court ruled that it did not. And scholars are still questioning whether parts of Green's collection are authentic. Again, here's Neil Harris, the museum expert.
Museums represent authority. How the Museum of the Bible will fit into this community remains to be seen. It's going to be rather interesting.
You can see an example of the traditional ways museums in the nation's capital cover religion if you visit the Smithsonian Museum of American History. Peter Manceau is the curator of an exhibit there on religion in early America.
We try to follow the path set by the curators that have come before us and see the way potentially controversial moments have been captured through material culture previously.
The Smithsonian exhibit is much less flashy than the Museum of the Bibles. There are artifacts like Jefferson's Bible in glass cases with plaques that give historical context. For the kids, Manceau points to a display of a wooden Noah's Ark playset from the 1800s.
Features about 20 or so hand-carved animals, 2x2, of course.
Back over at the Bible Museum, there's an arcade where you can use a slingshot to shoot a rock through Goliath's head, like David did. It's a different approach. And Seth Pollinger of the Bible Museum says he wants to be very clear. There isn't one right way to interpret the Bible. He says the staff took pains to collaborate with scholars of all different denominations. They've even amassed the world's largest collection of Torah scrolls, the Holy Jewish text.
If this museum is going to fit within this community and be part of this community, then we have to also discuss those issues. So certainly haven't gotten there yet, but I hope we can continue to make progress.
As the museum welcomes its first crop of visitors this weekend, people will be watching to see how a museum devoted to religion fares in Washington, D.C., just blocks from the White House and the U.S. Capitol. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lefrak in Washington.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
In recent years, public transit agencies around the country have seen rising ridership. So it was a surprise to learn this week that the number of people riding the New York City subway has been dropping. According to the MTA, average weekday ridership was 5.7 million in September of this year, down nearly 2% from the same time the year before. Joining us now is John Raskin, the executive director of the Riders Alliance, a New York public transit advocacy group. John, welcome.
Thank you.
And why do you think ridership is down a little bit?
You know, after years of declining service, I think people are, in a sense, voting with their metric cards. They're deciding to opt out of a system that is increasingly frustrating and find other ways to get around instead.
And other ways, I'm thinking first and foremost Uber, but is that the only one?
You know, Uber's a part of it. Lyft is a part of it. People are driving private vehicles. Traffic is increasing in New York. And what that means is that people are getting off the subway and they're getting off the bus and they're finding other less efficient ways of getting around town.
Now, what does unreliable mean on the New York City subway right now? What are people complaining about?
You know, after many, many years of getting better and better, subway service has taken a sharp dive over the last 5 years. And it means that there are delays, there are breakdowns with old train equipment, and people get stuck in tunnels. It can be a very frustrating situation to be on public transit in New York these days.
How much of that is related to, for example, Hurricane Sandy and the closures that had to happen because of that?
You know, Hurricane Sandy doesn't help. Other climate change-related problems haven't helped. But the real problem is actually man-made. It's just years and years of underinvestment in our public transit infrastructure. That means we're working with signal technology from the 1930s and subway cars from the 1960s, and it's really no wonder that everything's breaking down.
Do you get the sense, as an outside advocate, that the MTA is worried about this drop in ridership, that they're ready to take steps that you've been advocating for in order to fix the problems and make people more happy with the subway?
You know, interestingly, the MTA is taking steps, and I wouldn't say that they're ultimately the source of the problem. It goes beyond the MTA, and it's our elected leaders who are making decisions about budget and legislation and kind of whether or not they're giving the MTA the resources it needs to do its job. And that's been a problem for a long time in New York.
What does it need to do? What's your dream scenario for the subway in New York?
You know, the subway needs an urgent modernization plan. It needs an infusion of billions of dollars in new revenue that's sustained over the long term so that it can buy new subway cars, it can upgrade old signal technology, and it can kind of have a modern system that people can rely on day to day.
We've reported on the new Second Avenue subway that just opened. How's that been going? And has that made a big difference in how crowded some of the subway trains are?
You know, it shows you the scale that New York is on. We've opened only 3 new stations for the Second Avenue subway, and still hundreds of thousands of people are already benefiting from it. You know, I think that's one example of demonstrating to people how investment in transit infrastructure really does make a difference in people's lives.
You know, some of us who live in cities outside of New York find it a little funny when New Yorkers are complaining about their subway because it's so much better than so many other subway systems around the country. What do you think about that?
It is, and it's also better than it was, you know, 30, 35 years ago when it was really in horrible condition. But New York is built around the subway system. It's the only reason that New York has such a powerful economy and a growing population. And it means that when the subway doesn't work, the entire city suffers the consequences.
That's John Raskin, who is executive director of the Riders Alliance, a New York public transit advocacy group. John, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Republican plans on health care and taxes have been very visibly debated. Judicial appointments, not so much. President Obama inherited 54 openings after the Bush presidency. The Obama White House said Republicans obstructed their appointments. And President Trump did inherit nearly double the number of vacancies, 103. But back in October, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell faced backlash from conservative groups over how slowly they were being confirmed. Now, the pace has quickened. For more, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is here. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Robin.
And this week, Senator Ted Cruz said, when the history books are written about the Trump administration, I believe perhaps the most long-lasting and significant legacy will be the men and women appointed and confirmed to the federal bench. Take us back, eighth grade civics. What's the importance of these lower courts?
The importance of the lower courts is that they often make the decisions that affect people's lives when they're involved in cases in federal court. So federal district judges find the facts in cases. And what that means is that they're establishing the record that will then be looked at by an appellate judge if there is an appeal. Often there is no appeal, and the final judgment comes from that district court ruling. And then the judges on the courts of appeal most often make an absolutely final ruling because the Supreme Court takes dozens of cases out of the hundreds or even thousands that are in the federal judiciary every year. And so what we have with our regional court of appeals is, in effect, a decision maker for large bodies of cases and also for areas of law that the Supreme Court has not entirely clarified yet.
So where are we with the Trump administration as far as confirmations? How many does he have?
The Trump administration has 12 confirmations so far. 8 of those are to the appellate courts. And he's nominated a total of 44 people to the federal bench. And that is the swiftest pace we've seen since the days of President Richard Nixon. Obama, during his first year, scored 10 confirmations in the Senate. And that was including Justice Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. Yeah. So his pace of nominations was slower, and so was the pace of confirmations.
Well, and talk about the people that have been nominated. There's a very controversial one, Brett Talley. Nominated to be a federal judge in Alabama. The Senate Judiciary Committee has approved the nomination, but why such a flashpoint?
Well, what's come out in the last few days is that Talley is married to the chief of staff for the White House counsel, Don McGahn. McGahn has been very influential in choosing nominees, and Talley didn't disclose this family connection in his Senate questionnaire where you're asked about potential conflicts of interest. So this raises a question about, his transparency and then also about how he would handle any matter before him involving the Trump administration because his wife works for it.
Well, and also, aren't there agencies that are supposed to kind of vet these nominees? And many of them, including Talley, have been said to be not qualified.
Right. So the American Bar Association has played an historic role in giving qualified or well-qualified or not qualified ratings to federal judicial nominees. It's a role that the ABA takes very seriously. And Talley is one of a tiny number of people who have received a not qualified rating. Since 1989, the group has unanimously rated only two other judicial nominees as not qualified. One of the reasons for this is that Talley has never tried a case. He's worked as a deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. He also worked for the Alabama Attorney General, but he has not himself conducted a trial.
Look, candidate Trump made it very clear he wanted to appoint conservative justices. This is not a stealth campaign. He is working closely with conservative groups who put forth their nominees. It's said that he could name up to 30% of the federal bench in his first four-year term. Can he flip courts to conservative sides? Can he flip what are normally left-leaning courts?
Well, it all depends on where the vacancies lie and how quickly they're filled. But yes, for sure. I mean, this is part of the power of being president. You get to pick these judges. And as the vacancies arise, the political composition of the courts change. So I think we can expect that to happen in several regional appellate courts around the country. And you're right. This was absolutely something that Trump promised during the campaign. And in general, conservatives have been better at mobilizing around judges than liberals have. Conservatives get that this is a long-lasting power. The quote you read at the top from Senator Cruz is a great example of a recognition and also a celebration of what it means to populate the federal bench with people who agree with you.
Yeah. Well, and that might be why President Trump has a lot of support, even if Republicans haven't made much headway in Congress, on health care repeal or the tax plan, which, may or may not end up being passed. This is what many conservatives are looking for.
That's right. You hear conservatives say that the Trump presidency is worth simply Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. And so these lower court judges, as they get approved, they kind of add to that sense that the judiciary with these lifetime tenure appointments is very valuable and that lots of, important law and even sort of policy decisions get made by judges, get vetted by judges in these particularly highly contested issues in American life. The Second Amendment, how vast are the scope of people's rights to bear arms? What about the right to abortion? What about religious liberty rights? All these things come before the courts. We've seen with the travel ban cases this year how much in the spotlight federal judges can be.
Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the Trump administration is also making its mark in media. Yesterday, the FCC, led by Trump appointee Ajit Pai, voted to repeal a 42-year-old rule regulating the way broadcast media companies can be bought and sold. The original regulations were put in place to ensure a diversity of voices and opinions on air and in print. Pai said the rules were outdated in a digital age. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has thoughts. David, first explain more about what this 42-year-old rule said people couldn't do.
Well, so there are a couple of rules that are being swept away and a few more being proposed to be jettisoned. But one of the key ones was this one from the 70s, where it limits the ability of media companies to own a newspaper and a local TV station in the same company, market or region. And Ajit Pai said that this was, a dusty thinking from a different age, earlier generations, that, with a welter of new conduits of information through Facebook and the web more generally, why we didn't need to worry so much about how many voices were dominating those particular areas. Having worked in smaller markets, I can tell you if you only have two or three TV stations or four or five in town and one newspaper in town, it can matter who's producing all that news that you consume. And I think it's worth pointing out that, studies from the Pew Center and other places will tell you that even as they're enormous number of new platforms in which you can consume information. Newspapers and to some extent local TV really produce a great amount of the content that we consume. So people often mistake who owns the platform you're looking at thing with who's producing it, and those are often two very different outfits.
Right. So who stands to benefit? I mean, what might happen if now that this goes through?
I think you're going to see even more media consolidation. You know, it seems as though you think of Comcast buying NBC Universal, think of Time Warner putting itself up for sale. That's not a competitors, but the sort of complementary outfits. Well, you know, is Verizon going to buy folks more? Are you going to see even more media outfits? Hearst has multiple outfits. You see the Murdoch empire. If you look at the two wings of it, 21st Century and Fox, theoretically, Rupert Murdoch has had his eye on the LA Times for a very long time. Might he want to take a run at it? I think there are reasons why he's unlikely to at the moment. But, you know, there are ways in which big players can get a lot bigger. And he's also, the FCC has also swept away other rules that limited how many news or TV stations you could own in a specific market. So at the same time, there's an elimination of these inhibitions from people to own two different kinds of outfits in the same market. There's inhibitions on who can own a lot of the same kind of the market. And for local news, local TV is a huge place people turn for.
The Washington Post is reporting that another big beneficiary could be Sinclair, the conservative broadcasting company. They want to buy up Tribune Media. But we just have about a minute here. The FCC also voted to eliminate the program that subsidizes broadband and phone service for low-income households. Thoughts?
Well, this seems pretty hard-hearted. It's being presented as modernizing. There are ways in which households are subsidized. People, you know, in tribal areas, lower-income houses, where there were ways in which it was allowing there to be some competition for the kinds of services people could get for internet service, and also more recently for broadband to be subsidized. We really are at a time where broadband is almost a necessity for internet use and for people to telecommute. People have a chance to get jobs, and in some of these areas, some of these families that were relying on these subsidies have this taken away seems to just keep them one foot farther away from being in step with the rest of society.
Yeah. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
Republicans are a couple steps closer to passing a tax overhaul before the end of the year. Yesterday, the House approved its $1.5 trillion version of the bill. And yesterday, the Senate Finance Committee passed its own bill, which includes a provision to repeal the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act. That bill will head to the Senate floor after Thanksgiving. The whole process has been happening very fast, and we want to answer some questions, if we can, with Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the central claim from Republicans that the middle class gets the benefits from this bill. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was on CNBC this morning.
The focus of the plan really is middle-income tax cuts and delivering those right away, in making our business tax system competitive. There are certain parts of this that expire, but we have every expectation that down the road that Congress will extend them.
Mike, do the numbers that are out there support that claim that this is for the middle class?
Well, it's definitely true that not everyone in the middle class will benefit. It all depends on what deductions and tax credits you take advantage of. And there's also the fact of those expirations that the Treasury Secretary mentioned. A lot of people aren't so confident that they will expire as people are hoping they will. But to me, one of the most interesting things, it's very technical, but it's very important. It's how the government adjusts for inflation. Now, tax brackets and deductions are increased each year to account for inflation. But both versions of these bills want to switch the way they calculate inflation to what's called chained CPI, in other words, a chained version of the consumer price index. And I won't bore you with all the details, but what it basically means is that under a chained CPI index, the tax brackets would not go up as much every year. So in other words, you're more at risk of entering a higher tax bracket than you would be under the old system. So there's some, Greg Ipp at the Wall Street Journal has an interesting column on this, and others arguing that it sort of equates to a hidden tax increase in coming years for many people.
What about the economic impact of a part of the Senate bill, which is the repeal of the individual mandate in Obamacare? We've already heard that 13 million people would lose their health insurance over the next decade. But what is the bigger economic impact here?
Right. And this is obviously one of the most contentious parts of the Senate bill. And the Joint Committee on Taxation yesterday said that this would actually lead to a 13% tax hike for Americans making between $20,000 and $30,000 a year by 2021.
They would pay more for health insurance.
Well, and they would not be eligible for refundable tax credits under the bill. So that is going to, I think, going to be very much a battleground of this bill.
Now, President Trump has claimed that the tax overhaul plan will not help him personally or people like him. Here he is speaking in September.
Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me.
Mike, is that true? Will these tax cuts help Trump personally?
Well, obviously, his tax returns are a big secret, so no one knows for sure. But there's obviously a lot of skepticism about that. One of the things a lot of people are talking about is one loophole they're not looking to close is a break for golf course owners. So clearly Trump would benefit from that. Also, the reduction in the pass-through income rate and changes to the alternative minimum tax, if those were to survive, they would obviously potentially affect President Trump's taxes, as well as the estate tax is clearly something that would benefit his kids.
Now, we put out a call today on Twitter asking people to send in their questions about the tax cut package. And let me just get to a couple of them. First of all, what can people do if they want to stop this bill?
Well, it's not a lot. I mean, you can always call your senator, call your representative and make a stink. Obviously, people in Alabama, voters in that state, have a very big opportunity if they are upset with this tax plan. That election is looking to be very close now because of Roy Moore's scandal. You know, the question will be, especially in the Senate, if the Republicans can get enough votes. And there are several senators on the fence. So probably if you did want to, you know, be a citizen lobbyist, you'd identify those fence sitters and contact them.
One more question from Twitter. Tony Cope writes, how will this tax overhaul affect small businesses? I own an S Corp.
Well, I think in general, again, it all depends on your individual business's situation, but it does look like a decent situation for small business owners. That said, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, one of the small business lobbyist groups, and some other small business groups are not thrilled with it. Mainly, they feel like it could go further. And it's also to point out, you know, small business owners, especially beneficiaries of the pass-through tax reduction, are often very affluent people.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now.